This is The End User, episode 171 for Tuesday, May 13th. We shall mourn the whimsical poke. Hello and welcome to The End User, the show where we get together and talk about our experience with consumer technology with a bit of news from your perspective. The End User.
It's the tech news that you can use.
I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Marr. And Chris, we're going to start this week with some news from the future, which is to say a rumor that Apple may start its biggest acquisition yet. Supposedly, they're making an offer for Beats Electronics, makers of the eponymous headphones, for $3.2 billion.
Whoa. That's a pretty big sum of money. So I guess the question is assuming that this little bit of rumor is true, and assuming that they actually go through with and purchase Beats, do you think it really fits in with Apple's bigger kind of consumer strategy?
I don't know. And I don't think anybody really knows what exactly Apple is looking to gain from Beats headphones, which is a company that's traditionally aligned themselves with Android phones and HP computers. Yeah, and expensive name brand products, which I guess, depending on how you feel about it, is exactly what Apple makes or the exact opposite.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of a conflict there because what they do have in common is that they're both a very strong consumer brand, right? Beats is very popular, particularly with the kids these days, you know. No, but particularly in the younger market, I think. And what's a little curious about it is I'm not sure that Beats is really up to the quality snuff of the kind of quality effort that Apple would typically embody.
And yet they're a very popular brand, and Apple may be able to capitalize on that. And as a fan of Apple products, I think initially that Apple acquiring Beats only makes Beats products better, right? And that's not entirely unheard of to me. Apple has tried to get into the music accessories business. I mean, they created the modern music accessories business, but making high-end speakers and high-end headphones is something that Apple's tried many times over the last 10 years or so, and it has always ended with lackluster performance. So first they had their iPod Hi-Fi, right?
It was right, a long
big
time ago.
Battery-powered boombox that right. was supposed to be just a big iPhone or iPod dock. And then they had their premium headphones, which were supposed to be a $2 pair of headphones for the cost of $80. And I have those and I still use them and I think that they're great. But there's no shortage of speculation as to why Apple might buy Beats Electronics. Every major news outlet that reports in this market is commenting on it and coming up with their own explanations. Some people say Apple's positioning itself against Spotify, or they're trying to maintain a youth market or some sort of hip association with these particular headphones. Maybe it's just a joke. Maybe it's totally off base as a rumor. The point is no one knows, and Ars Technica has a great article about no one knows why Apple's doing this. But assuming it's true, which we don't know for sure that it is, we will find out in time. And I don't know. I can see a couple of different reasons why this might make sense for Apple. First and foremost, meaning they spent 3.2 Instagrams, or they might spend that much money on Beats, but they have $160 billion in cash sitting around for things like this.
Yeah, so that means that they can kind of afford to overpay a little bit if their negotiations are in Beats' favor.
I mean, we can talk about the quality of Beats products all day, but it doesn't change the fact that they are an immensely popular brand.
Oh, yes.
That $3 billion is an overvalued amount.
Yeah, it just seems like a lot for a low-pass filter.
Yeah, but that's not what they're buying. They're buying the brand. I know.
No, it's like, it's totally the brand, right?
If Apple wanted to make the exact same products that Beats was making, but better, they could.
Yeah, if they wanted to go after, Sennheiser's headphones division, they don't have nearly the cachet that Beats has with a younger audience right now.
Right, exactly.
So I can see why they would go after Beats in that sense, although I'm just... It'll be interesting to see where they kind of fit in because, it's a little hard to understand from the headphones perspective, but I think the streaming music perspective makes a little bit more sense.
Maybe. Again, it's really hard to say, and I can see it from the headphones perspective, but clearly it has something to do with the brand, the popularity, the cachet, and we don't know what that is, and we won't find out for a while.
And Taylor, as you know, I'm a enthusiast of Bluetooth headphones, and my phone has Beats Audio built into it. Remember when HTC did that deal? But it's not enabled for Bluetooth headphones, so every time I turn on my headphones to listen to something, I am mocked by the fact that that Beats is unavailable on my phone in that mode. So maybe I'm just bitter from seeing that every day.
It tells you every time that you use your Bluetooth headphones that Beats Audio is unavailable?
Well, so when you like turn up the volume or something, it'll say Beats is enabled. And then when you turn the Bluetooth on, it'll tell you that it's now disabled.
Well, Beats may be disabled for Windows Phone forever, so get used to it.
That's right. That's right. No, I can't imagine that they would change that much. Do you think Apple would restrict them from dealing better with Android, or you think they would let them kind of stay on that course?
I would expect a complete overhaul of the product integration strategy.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Apple's not somebody to buy something like this and then back off of it like Google has done in the past.
Even Google doesn't do that for very long. Many of Google's acquisitions have gone Android-centric as soon as they're fully integrated into Google's corporate culture. Same with Microsoft and Skype. I mean, you can still get Skype for other platforms, but it works a lot better on Microsoft products now than anyone else. And Google, with their acquisitions, they tend to shut the product down and then re-release it as their own feature.
Right. Well, so I don't know. Only the future will tell, but I guess we can... When that actually happens, we'll talk about the little bit of details. But as it stands right now, it looks like Apple is rumored to buy Beats for 3.2 Instagrams. So shall we move into our next top news story of the week? And this is a very interesting one. We were going to talk about this one before, but we wanted to let it actually materialize a little bit. But this is a phone.
Yeah, we did mention the OnePlus One phone before. And we've been holding off on it because we wanted to, one, know for sure that it was going to reach markets outside of China, and two, that it would have reviews, and the reviews turned out to be quite good.
Yeah, very, very, very positive reviews coming out for the OnePlus One. So
let's recap. What is the OnePlus One?
So the OnePlus One is a $300 off-contract unlocked premium Android device that runs CyanogenMod. So CyanogenMod is just a version of Android that doesn't come bundled with the Google apps, and it's typically you take CyanogenMod and put it onto an Android device that already had a different version of Android on it. But this one is coming right out of the box with CyanogenMod. So what's, I think, the most interesting thing about this device is the price point. So this is a premium phone. It, you know, it's a 5.5-inch display. It's got a 1080p IPS panel on it. It's kind of on par with the Galaxy S5 and the HTC One M8. But it's got about half the price of those kind of devices. So, again, that's about $300 off contract, at least.
Yeah, and the goal of this company was to create the perfect Android phone, and they've managed to do it for $300 full stop, and that's really interesting. And the reviews are glowing. It looks like a fantastic phone. I mean, honestly, Chris, the kid who is a pre-Apple fanboy in me really wants this phone.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's funny because we've been saying this for years. Look, all you have to do to make a good Android phone is keep it simple, don't screw with Android too much, and just release a phone that has decent hardware, doesn't have a particularly flashy design aesthetic, and, you know, have a decent screen. That's all you have to do to make a good Android device, and that's exactly what they've done. And they've done it far below the price point that even the Nexus devices are hitting. So I think that they're kind of experimenting here a little bit, though. Do you think they can't? I can't imagine they make much profit on a $300 device.
I don't know. It's impossible for me to say what kind of profit they're making on it, but I'm sure that someone will tear it down, add up the cost of the parts, and figure out the rough profit that they're going to start generating from this phone.
Yeah, so we'll see when it comes to iFixit, I guess.
I suppose we will. Yeah, so I like that it just it focuses on these essential premium basics and puts it into a slick package without trying to include a heart rate monitor, right, a hygrometer, a button on the back, a third camera. It's just a great looking, really thin device with an excellent screen. It's just a slab of plastic and awesome.
Yeah, I really, if you keep it simple and get out of the way, then it looks like at least the gadget reviewers are going to like this device. Now, I don't know how interested the normal kind of on contract every 2 years kind of people are going to be interested in this, but the geeks of the world, I think, have generated a lot of excitement about this device.
You know, I'm finding that fewer and fewer people among the people that I meet here in Washington, D.C. are those two-year contract type of people, especially now that the major carriers here have lowered the incentive to get a new phone every 2 years. It used to be every 2 years meant every 18 months.
Yeah,
just
true.
Keep signing up for a new contract and keep getting a new phone early.
Yeah, so, and we've never had more options in terms of the MVNOs in the world, the, you know, Virgin Mobile and the like. So I think maybe that also has something to do with it, because there's a ton of those kind of carriers nowadays when there just wasn't in the past.
Well, the interesting thing is Virgin Mobile has been around for more than 10 years, and Boost Mobile is another competitor, and there are other ones out there. But the interesting thing now is that they are getting good phones off contract for as cheap or cheaper than what the major carriers can offer. And so now we're seeing phones like the OnePlus One that are giving you that same good phone for cheap experience that you can use anywhere, except for probably Cricket or Boost or Verizon or Virgin Mobile, I mean.
All right, so this will not work on Sprint or Verizon. They have a GSM chip set in there, so it'll be welcome on AT&T and T-Mobile. They've got a quad-band GSM Edge chip in there, so that means AT&T and T-Mobile here in the United States. So I'm not sure when us consumers will see it. All the review models are out, but it's going to be sometime soon. So it's good to see.
They've claimed that it's going to roll out internationally in June.
Right. Okay. So sometime in June, we'll see it actually happen. So that's good to see.
Yes, it is. With that, should we turn on our afterburners, Chris?
Yes, let's do. Let's get into the afterburners. And Taylor, if you'd like to make a gin fizz and securely fasten your seatbelt, we can get into it.
I might hold off on the gin fizz. But we warned you 2 weeks ago that Netflix was going to raise their prices. And
the apocalypse.
They have officially raised their prices $1 from $7.99 to $8.99 for the streaming-only plan. Now, this comes pretty much directly on the heels of Netflix coming with payment agreements to Comcast and Verizon. And I'm expecting more last mile internet carriers in the US. And so if you have Netflix, but you're not on Comcast and Verizon, well, if you're just signing up for Netflix and you have to pay $8.99 instead of $7.99, you're paying more because of Comcast and Verizon asking for more money from Netflix. And so you're paying more money for no benefit. And if you already have Comcast and Verizon and not Netflix, then they should be giving you a discount because they're charging Netflix for premium access to you. And so if you don't get that benefit, you should be charged less. Good luck calling Comcast or Verizon and asking for that. But I tried, and it was worth my 10 minutes just to complain to them a little more because I haven't been happy with the service.
Yeah, and I can understand why for sure. So Twitter is introducing a new feature. They're adding the capability to mute somebody on Twitter. So you can follow someone, but then mute them so that you don't see the updates they post to their Twitter stream. So that's available now on iOS and Android devices or the Twitter web interface as well.
I remember when this was only a third-party web app,
yeah,
and you mute somebody, but what the website would do is just unfollow you from that person and then follow them at a later time. So Google Maps is also getting some new features for Android, and they are adding integration with the Uber car service, so you can look up directions to somewhere and then hit one tap and it'll take you right to Uber and order the cab. They've also improved their offline modes, so you can save offline maps in a custom list and also store directions offline. And they've added some other improvements to transit results and reviews for places that you are considering about going and some other bug fixes.
So Square is upending part of its business, at least. They're going to get rid of the Square Wallet service, which was introduced about 3 years ago. That allowed people to pay with the app and then tell the proprietor in some way that they had paid for it to pay for things in stores. So what they are introducing is called Square Order. And that is kind of a order ahead deal where you can phone in an order with the app and pay for it, and then all you have to do is pick it up. So they're kind of pivoting a little bit in that regard.
Yeah, this is sort of another example of app proliferation. I really liked Square Wallet, actually. I thought it worked really well. It was a little overzealous with GPS activity. Whenever I would walk near any establishment that had Square Wallet enabled, yeah, like sometimes right. If I was in a car on an adjacent street, it would tell me, hey, you're ready to pay at this Mexican restaurant. I was like, I'm in a car. I'm not at the Mexican restaurant.
It was the geofence service, right?
Yeah, but I did enjoy the service, and so I'm hesitant about Square Order. I feel like I've been betrayed. And that's probably how the head of Samsung Mobile Design feels. He was let go. And we have talked about this on the show before. The design of Samsung's flagship phones has been really lackluster. They're basic plastic and glass bricks, which I know I just touted earlier in the show with the OnePlus One. But these don't look as good as the ones that are on offer from Motorola or OnePlus One or some of the other phones that are out there, and I guess that Samsung is deciding to go in a new direction.
Yeah, so I think that's kind of exciting from my perspective. I'd like to see them try something a little more high-designed than what they're doing right now. So if that's what it takes to get that to happen, then this is a good thing, and I'm not sure it's going to change anything. So we'll have to wait and see if there's any actual consequence here.
So in an example of app non-proliferation, just like we discussed last week, Facebook is pulling two of its apps, probably its least popular apps, the Poke and Camera apps. Now, Camera was a blatant, half-hearted attempt at copying Instagram. And then Facebook paid $1 billion for Instagram and never updated its Camera app again. So I understand why they got rid of it. Poke, I really enjoyed it. I wish that more people used it. The problem with Poke was that you both parties had to opt in, and then you could engage in some silly back and forth using the app. Longtime Facebook members might remember that Poke was its original killer feature. It was just you poked someone, and then they would be notified that you poked them. And it was this idea of building whimsy into this social network app that was novel at the time. And I think if you know how to do it, you can still poke someone on Facebook. But the app has been deleted from the iOS and Google app marketplaces.
And we shall mourn the whimsical Poke.
We shall.
So LG has announced three new products. They've got a host of their tablets coming out. They're called G-Pad, all of them. And they've got a 7-inch device, they've got an 8-inch device, and they've got a 10.1-inch device. So there's not a lot of other media details about this up yet. They've got a little screenshot, and I'm sure we'll get some more details about this later.
All right, that's the end of our afterburners. Let's turn them off. Let's unbuckle our seatbelts. And Chris, will you wait 2 minutes while I make a gin phase?
Yes, I will wait here patiently with the chat room.
Just kidding. I'm Futurist Prime. I already made it. I'm back. Let's get into the end user stories.
Nice. We've got some Apple rumors to talk about. We normally don't talk about rumors, but this one had such breadth that we figured we'd cover a little bit. What's going on with Apple and the next iPhone?
So we are hearing from Reuters and a number of other sources, and this rumor has really just caught on. I've heard it everywhere already. People won't stop talking about it. They're saying that the next incarnation of the iPhone will come out in August, a month or two earlier than we've come to expect in the last few years, and that it will have a 4.7-inch screen, and that it will be called the iPhone 6. Now, what I would like to point out about these rumors, as prevalent or as well-sourced as they may be, is that they are just rumors, and Apple doesn't let us know about phones before they come out. They come out with something, they have a big announcement, and they try to get it into their stores as quickly as possible. So this may very well be the case. I'm still a little skeptical, but everyone should be a little skeptical. This is not a sure thing at all, and there have been many very popular rumors of this type that have turned out to be spurious in nature.
Yeah, I think that they're going to make the screen a little bit bigger. What I don't think they're going to do is make it 4.7 inches. That seems like a bit much to me. Maybe they'll go up to 4.2 or 4.3. If I were a betting man, that would be my range right there.
No, I don't think that it's going to be that small of a shift.
Well, we'll have to wait and find out, I guess.
Well, you won't. Yeah. Well, I have to wait until I can talk about it with you.
Right. Yeah, you're under NDA from the future.
That's right.
All right, well, let's get into some interesting news coming from Parrot. I'm not sure we've talked about Parrot before. Do you remember? I don't think we have.
I don't know, but I've definitely been reading a little bit about this. So this is a maker of remote control quadcopters.
And the idea is to kind of have the first affordable consumer multi-purpose drone of some sort. And they're hoping that this device is going to be somewhere between $300 and $400. And you're right, it's a quadcopter, and you can fly it around. It's got a camera on it. It's got a 1080p, 14-megapixel fisheye camera on it, more specifically.
All right. Now, are you talking about the mini drone that they came out with at CES or the newly unveiled Bebop?
No, the newly unveiled Bebop.
Okay, so let's talk about the mini drone just for a second first. This is the affordable drone that's for everybody, right? And the Bebop is a new product that's supposed to have a little bit more of capability. And most notably, it's expected to work with the Oculus Rift.
Right, that's the cool bit. So in theory, you can fly this this quadcopter around and have the Oculus Rift on and pilot it as if you were the drone.
Yeah, that's crazy. I feel week I saw the first tech demo of that concept from a research university, and the fact that Parrot is already pushing this to market is unbelievable. I mean, the Oculus Rift hasn't gone to market yet, and they're already building custom purpose virtual reality drone quadcopter.
Yeah, or at least they're experimenting with it. You'll remember that we never actually saw the drone they showed off at CES hit the market. But this one looks a little more promising. It looks to be a little bit more polished than their previous offering. And I don't think they're ever going to hit anything more than enthusiasts. But it is cool to see that they can get the price down that low with this kind of device. I wonder if they get popular enough, if the FAA is going to have to say something about it. I'm sure they already have regulations that I don't know about that are in place for consumer operated quadcopters.
They do a great deal of regulations, mostly that anything in public airspace is prohibited, and there are already several court cases that are getting started challenging the FAA's regulations on drones.
Yeah, and they'll change slowly, but they'll change.
Well, meanwhile, passenger aircraft are having near misses with drones in Florida this past week. And so public opinion may shift one way or the other. It's hard to say.
Yeah, but this is supposed to be the first kind of drone that really leaves behind its hobbyist past. I think that's kind of the idea, at least. So I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if there is a large interest in this kind of device. And I think it'll be interesting to see how it kind of fits into to the market.
I don't know. It's hard to say. I think that there are definitely toy helicopters that exist outside hobbyist market, and certainly a lot more that exist inside the hobbyist market. And it sort of just depends on how much you're willing to pay and how much work you're willing to do. The line between a small quadcopter drone and a small quadcopter toy is beginning to be too fine of a one to define as something like
true
hobbyist toy versus mass market toy.
Yeah, very true. So it'll be interesting to see where they go with that. So we'll kind of stay tuned. But they've got some serious cool technology. That's why we wanted to talk about it a little bit here. So good stuff, Parrot. Keep up the good work.
Well, I'm interested to hear about this week's green tech story, because this is not my story. It's yours, Chris.
Yeah, so I've got an interesting one. I found this on Hacker News sometime through the week, and it is a refrigerator that doesn't need any electricity. And I know that headline is a little bit misleading, because you do actually need electricity. You need electricity to kind of charge it up. But then once you've applied the electricity in the first place, what it does is it creates a block of ice in the top compartment of the refrigerator, and it can then, using some special kind of passive technology, keep the refrigerator at 4 degrees Celsius for around 10 days, depending on your climate. So the target market is not necessarily keeping your steak cold. The idea is that you would take this into a third world country, or a place where some disease is outbreaking or something like that. And you would be able to keep vaccines cool, and medicine cool, and maybe insulin cool, something like that. So there's a good video on the post we're sharing that explains a lot about how this thing works. But generally, there's two sides to the fridge that are hollow, and there's an ice block in a chamber on the top. And when you plug it in, it freezes that ice block. And when you unplug it, the water in the ice slowly melts away and goes down the edges. And then there's something about how the water on the bottom keeps the refrigerator cool. So again, there's a lot more science than what I just mentioned behind this, but it seems like a very cool application to a pretty simple idea.
Yeah, this is exactly the kind of thing that I think about when I talk about green tech. And it is really amazing that they're able to do this, and they're trying to reach 20% of children worldwide who don't have ready access to healthcare. And certainly that is a very important application. But reading about this technology and how good it is at refrigeration without power, I immediately start thinking of more mundane applications, how you could take a technology like this and replace a normal grid connected energy hogging refrigerator with something like this, and whether that could be more efficient. Certainly on RVs, in planes, at festivals and camping applications, anywhere where the power supply is spotty, the ability to keep things cold for up to 35 days is game-changing for refrigeration. I mean, imagine if they had had this technology 100 years ago, food production would have changed drastically.
Yeah, yeah. It definitely seems like a good tool in the tool belt. I don't think it's going to replace the grid-connected refrigerator tomorrow, but I think it's definitely a good little tool to have in your tool belt.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's important to develop this and get it working properly and get vaccines to children in developing world or in developing nations. But I would also like to see what else we can do with this technology in the future.
All right, well, let's move on. We're going to skip over the tip of the week, and we're going to move into the app pick of the week. And not surprisingly...
Well, it's sort of an app pick tip, right? Because yeah, everybody knows about Firefox.
Now, I guess it's a little bit of a combined tip and app pick of the week. But yeah, Firefox had a major user interface overhaul, and I am liking it a lot. I'm trying to see, you know, I've talked about this before. I always go over to, I've done this with Firefox and I've done this with Opera, and I try to jump off of Chrome just to kind of lessen the Google in my life and see if I can really depend on another browser. Now, I always come running back to Chrome. So Firefox has released version 29, and they've overhauled the user interface, and honestly, it looks a lot more like Chrome than it did previously, which I guess in my case, that's a good thing. But they've made a ton of usability improvements, and it's good to see them kind of move forward and do something a little bit different in that realm.
Cool. So how long do you think it had been since you last used Firefox?
Oh, I still use it every day, particularly they have really nice CSS tools if you're designing something.
Awesome. All right, so then what is your favorite new thing about Firefox 29?
So the most different thing, I guess, is the way all of the menus work is just different now. And I think it's different in a positive way. You know, they had the file menu originally, like most apps did. And then Chrome came out and said, no, we don't have file menus. And so Firefox, instead of having a file menu, they moved all the tabs up to the top of the screen and they put a Firefox button off on the left instead of the file menu, which I always thought was an acknowledgement that Chrome was right without going all the way with it. So they've moved that button off to the right to give you the maximum amount of tab space on the upper left, and the tabs are now flush against the top of your screen, which I think is the right thing to do.
Okay, yeah, I like it that way as well, and that's definitely the biggest difference between Chrome and Firefox and Safari between Windows and OS X.
Yeah,
is their implementation of, you know, how high up into the window can you put your tabs? How little wasted space can you use?
Now, this is going to sound a little crazy, but I really enjoyed one of the developer tool features. And don't worry, this isn't too involved. But, you know, you can use JavaScript to remove HTML elements. And, you know, when you're building up a web page, you might want to remove a text box, let's say. So when you're looking at the HTML in the developer tools now, if you use some JavaScript to remove something or add something into the HTML document, it'll now flash a little orange as it's happening. So you kind of get this idea of where things are happening if you're looking in the developer tools. So I know that's a little bit off our reservation, but I thought that was really neat. I hadn't seen any other browser do something like that.
Nice. Yeah, that's really cool. I may have to check out Firefox for OS X and see how that one's running.
Yeah, I know they haven't updated on Linux yet, because I tried to look for an update and there was none. So you'll have to look on the Mac and see if you like it. I can say with confidence, this is the first time in a while I think I've really even thought about switching back to Firefox for full-time usage from Chrome. So I'm going to give it a try, and we'll kind of see what happens. But hopefully it goes a little bit better than last time.
Okay, cool.
All right, so let's get into our kicker. What do you got for us?
All right, so this is definitely in the realm of hobbyist
yes.
niche categories, right? We were talking about the difference between a helicopter toy and a quadcopter drone and where that blurs the line between just easy mass market toys and hobbyist things. And this is definitely a hobbyist example of a mass market interface. So along with the latest generation consoles, the Nintendo Wii U, the PlayStation 4, the Xbox 360, it turns out there is this little market out there for people updating original generation consoles. So I'm talking pretty much exclusively about the Nintendo Entertainment System and the Super Nintendo Entertainment System. And what Ars Technica has is an article about people who have rebuilt and redesigned the system with modern gaming equipment. Now, a couple of months ago, I took apart an NES console, and looking at the inside of it, I was realizing, like, compared to modern technology, these things are very simple and very easy to understand.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And essentially analog in nature. You can take it apart, you can look at it, you can examine every single component and practically every transistor in there. And if you pay enough attention to the circuits in there, you can understand pretty much exactly what's going on. And you can replace and refine those circuits with high-end components that are available easily online now in a way that they weren't in the 80s when these components came out. So people are spending upwards of $500 recreating their own NES consoles from scratch with high-end components. Some people even have digital or even HDMI adapters and outputs just to enable them to get the best gaming experience out of an original NES or Super NES cartridge. And I just thought this was wild. It was obvious kicker material, and you should really see the system that's pictured in this article. It's a beautiful piece of equipment.
Yeah, the remake is just absolutely gorgeous. I can't believe how well that thing turned out. It's really nice looking. So yeah, I guess the meat is in the pictures of this one. So
this one was designed by a hacker and gamer named Christopher Tabor.
Yeah, so go have a link. Go have a look at the show notes. We've got a link to the picture here. Now, the one thing that is a little upsetting is if you hook this up to an LCD screen, no Duck Hunt for you.
Yeah, that's right. Well, Duck Hunt has been notoriously incompatible with LCD. Well, since there was LCD.
Well, I'm going to hold off on getting one of these until Flappy Bird is available. So hopefully somebody
Flappy
can make
Bird
it.
Flappy Bird with an actual console gamepad? I don't know. I feel like that's cheating.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like it would be, because it's nostalgic of the NES days, so I feel like it belongs there somehow.
Hmm. Maybe it does. I would certainly like to try it, but I would feel guilty.
All right, well, that will do it for this week. Taylor, I think if somebody were to try to contact you in some way, how would they do that? Perhaps using an NES console.
Right, well, it would have to be one that you built from scratch, and then you'd have to design your own Twitter NES user interface. Do you think anyone's ever done that before? Well, if they have, then you'll have to design something else. But once you've built this elaborately expensive console and determined some way by which you can interact with Twitter over it, you can send me a tweet. My handle is at TaylorPhone, TaylorPhone.
If you want to get at me, I am at Chris Hale Barnes. So give us a follow. Let us know what you think of the show. So Taylor, before we get on out of here, I also wanted to mention that I was on Entertainment 2.0 this last week. So,
That's awesome. Yeah. And you were on Home On recently as well. Is that one out yet?
Yes, that is not out yet. So we'll have to wait. I forget when exactly Richard publishes those. So we'll have to wait a little bit for that one. But the Entertainment 2.0 is out right now, and you can go and have a listen to that one. And shortly, we'll have Home On with me.
Awesome.
I had the hat trick this week, as Josh called it. All right, so that'll do it for us. It's time to get out of here. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the show. And, of course, you can find more information, including the show notes, over there at thedigitalmediazone.com under the end user. That's THENDUSR. The DMZ has a few other podcasts. As we mentioned, you can listen to Entertainment 2.0, Scene in HD, and the Movie Podcast, and Home On. You can also send us some feedback. We've got an email. It's theenduser@thedigitalmediazone.com, or you can follow us on Twitter. Together we are at The End User. You can join us in the chat room as we record the show live every Monday night around 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm your host and producer, Chris Barnes.
And I'm Futurist Prime, Taylor Mott.
Thanks for listening, folks. We will see you next week. Bye-bye.